Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosefan, Associate Professor at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. Actually, about 350 days out of the year, it's sunny here in Santa Clara, but today it happens to be raining, and all the people are rejoicing. We are rejoicing because we have been suffering this terrible drought. We had a multi-billion dollar bond issue on the ballot this past election season, which passed, and I think Californians across the board were of the mind, let's just get this problem solved. Whatever it takes, let's just do it. And I've often been of the opinion when I'm sort of on the road looking around at all the signage about droughts, and then I look on up and down the highway and I see all of these BMWs and Lexuses, and I think to myself, well, these BMWs aren't native to California, and yet we seem to have plenty of them on the road. Whatever we're doing to get the BMWs here, let's do that to get the water here. And then as I was driving in, I thought, I saw the rain coming down this morning. It was pouring down. And I thought, with these thoughts in the back of my mind, I thought, this is like free money. Why is it raining? Where it's like, it seemed like it was sort of like a gift. It was almost enough to turn one to religion. It didn't seem like it could be possible that this rain was just falling for free out of the sky and that it hadn't been monetized. I didn't understand it. It was a puzzle to me. But maybe that means I've been spending too much time thinking about corporate law issues. I'm honored and thrilled to have with me as guest today to talk about the ethics of corporate taxation, two executives from the Silicon Valley firm, or is it even right to characterize it as a Silicon Valley firm? We'll get into that in our conversation. But I have the pleasure of having Tim Seitz, who is a Senior Vice President of Flextronics Financial Supply Chain Design Group, and Jason Spicer, Vice President of Global Operations at Flextronics. Flextronics was founded here in the Silicon Valley in the late 1960s and is today truly a global corporation, a $25 billion electronics manufacturing concern with operations and employees in over 30 countries. Flextronics is today chartered in Singapore. It gets its corporate charter not from California, not from the state of Delaware, but from Singapore. And perhaps we can get into some of the reasons for that in the course of our conversation. Now, Tim is a lawyer, and so I feel like the rough and tumble is fair game whenever I'm talking with a lawyer. But Jason is a CPA, so I feel like I can plead ignorance anytime the conversation gets into anything even remotely technical. So I feel like I've got the conversation tilted in my favor in whichever direction we go. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being part of this conversation.
Thank you.
We're happy to be here.
So, Tim, let me start by asking you, and Jason, please feel free to jump in at any time. We're having this conversation in December of 2014. Earlier this year, President Obama, made a series of public remarks about the phenomena that we know as corporate inversions, but that got the tagline or the categorization of economic patriotism in much of the press coverage that followed. President Obama, in one of his remarks, said the following, that even as corporate profits are higher than ever, there's a small but growing group of big corporations that are fleeing the country to get out of paying taxes. He goes on, you know, some people are calling these companies corporate deserters. Now, I must remark that I think using the phrase some people are saying or some people are calling is itself an unethical rhetorical device. If President Obama wants to make that statement, he should just make it. But I think that many politicians and scholars and ordinary citizens are of the mind that corporations fleeing the United States for the purposes of reducing their tax liability is problematic from a public policy standpoint, and that such action is unpatriotic. Tim, can you provide us your perspective on the issue of tax inversions?
Yeah, sure, David. And it's actually a pretty complex issue. You know, for sure, in particular, you know, particularly over the summer as we headed into the elections, I think inversions were the rage. And I think that was fitting because I think the arguments that were being made and the hubbub that came up around it really was much more political in nature than it was substantive in terms of economic policy. And I think that has implications both for the characterization of this as being, you know, whether or not this is patriotic, number one, but also it then goes into kind of the questions of whether or not this is ethical or moral type of behavior. As we look at it, let me just kind of address the patriotism argument.
You know, even before you do that, could you describe for us what a tax inversion is and why a large corporation might want to do it? And then you can get into the normative issues of whether it's patriotic or troublesome.
Sure. So an inversion transaction, and the reason a company would focus on that, in general, an inversion simply is a U.S. company that, in the context of an acquisition of another foreign entity, and generally, you know, that would be a smaller foreign entity, moves its tax residence from the U.S. to a foreign country. So rather than being a U.S.-owned multinational, through this acquisition, it becomes a foreign-owned multinational, maybe a U.K. company. You'll see that a lot of the drug companies that were, you know, in the news were looking at acquiring either a U.K. or an Irish company and changing their tax residence from the U.S. to Ireland or to Switzerland. In the context of doing that, there's really two primary reasons, you know, why companies are driven to do that. And they're primarily competitiveness issues around the globe. A foreign-owned company has an advantage over U.S. companies in two major respects. You know, first, that foreign company, when it earns income outside of the country in which it's a resident, that income is not subject to tax in its home country of residence. So say, for example, in the U.S., a U.S. company that goes and is earning income in, say, France.
And by a U.S. company, you mean a firm that is chartered in the United States?
Yes, chartered, simply chartered. So that a U.S. company, you know, it's how we define your resident, is a company that is chartered in the U.S., earning income in France, will have to pay income tax on its earnings in France, plus would have to pay any tax in the U.S. on any income that hasn't been subject to tax.
Incremental tax.
So there'd be an incremental tax, right?
I'll just ask a series of clarifying questions sort of from the perspective of the ignorant, if you don't mind. So the scenario you just described, that's first as a matter of French law. The French government is taxing revenue that's made in France. And then as a matter of American law, the United States government is taxing income that the American chartered corporation has made, although there might be a deduction for taxes that were paid to the French government.
Correct. A deduction or a credit. So there'd be some level of incremental tax as a general rule, as opposed to if I'm an Irish company.
Yeah.
And I operate the exact same business in France.
Yeah.
Again, France would tax my French income, but Ireland, as a general rule, would not impose any incremental Irish tax on the income that I earn. That's a significant material advantage for the Irish company. If I'm competing in that market, the difference can oftentimes, you know, be upwards of 10 to 20%. I can use that 10 or 20% of savings in one of two ways. Either I reduce the cost of my product in France, gaining market share at the expense of the U.S. company, or I charge the same amount, equivalent amount, and I pocket that as terms of additional earnings that I can then turn around and use to invest any way that I want. So it's a significant advantage from that standpoint, you know, being able to be a non-U.S. company.
And so if I can just ask another clarifying question, if you have a company that's an American company chartered in the United States doing business in France, and then it recharters in Ireland to achieve the tax outcome that you just described, is it just a feature of American tax law that we sort of that the U.S. government allows that to happen? I mean, couldn't the U.S. government say it could theoretically say no, we're just going to keep taxing you on that income, irrespective of the fact that you have formally chartered in Ireland, if your operations are otherwise substantially here in the United States or something. I mean, that would be that's not the law, but it just so happens that that's not the law. Is that right?
Yeah, so they could, and I want to make two points. They said, first, they could make that the law, and then that, you know, kind of deals with, you know, should they follow the charter or should they follow management control? The question is, the USA, if I have all my management control sitting in the US, should be subject to tax in here. I think that the countries that have management control provisions very quickly have moved away from those is the general rule, because what they found is companies have moved. It's a job killer. What it does is then come, you know, all of a sudden you're going to find that the president, the CEO, the operational people are going to relocate to Ireland. While that may not seem like a big deal at the beginning, what invariably happens is all the R&D and the activity, you know, ends up following that over a period of years. And there's many, many studies that verify that. So you're right, they could do that. Now, the other thing that's really interesting that you raised, David, is when you look at that, is that just a function of the law? It's important to note that the U.S. is an extreme outlier in the way that they treat this because of the function of their law. They are one of the only countries in the entire OECD that actually subjects the foreign earnings of its domestic chartered resident companies to domestic tax. Almost every other country, including Germany, UK, Japan, in many respects, China has provisions that allow this, would allow your foreign earnings to go untaxed if domesticated and repatriated. So it's that unique feature of the U.S. law that you know, when it was imposed, is forcing this kind of behavior. If the U.S., for example, adhered to global norms and allowed U.S. companies to avoid U.S. income tax on their non-U.S. earnings, you would take away one of the most significant drivers for companies to invert. They would no longer have to do that in order to compete.
Great, thank you for that. One more clarifying question here is, so in our example of the U.S. Chartered company that recharters in Ireland, suppose they have significant business operations in the United States. Are there any corporate taxes paid in the United States? They're not chartered in the United States, but like this company does business in France, it also does business in the United States. So does that tax revenue come to the United States still?
So there's the other advantage too. So for sure, by doing this, you are not going to escape tax on income that's properly attributable to your U.S. activity. There's a whole host of laws and, you know, over several, you know, thousands of pages of tax regulations dealing with how you actually attribute income to your activity in the U.S. So the advantage, however, I mean, to be open about this, the other primary driver for inverting is a foreign company coming into the U.S. has advantages over a domestic company in the U.S. when it comes to the U.S. income tax planning. A foreign company is generally able to leverage up its U.S. enterprise with deductions that reduce its U.S. tax liability, and they put in that income goes into a jurisdiction where it's not subject to a very high tax rate at all. It may be repatriated to Germany at zero tax, just not subject to tax. So if I, if you know, and then I'm getting the full deduction in the U.S. So they do that with things like interest. They do that with management fees. They do that with royalties for IP that was generated outside of the U.S. in other transactions. If I'm a U.S. company and I've got my own IP and I have my management here, I can deduct that from, you know, management fees, obviously, but I don't have the ability to deduct foreign, you know, as easily in, you know, make, create deductions for foreign developed IP or foreign developed access to business process in systems or foreign management.
Okay, so now I'm sort of wanting to pose the question in the inverted way. You've described very, very clearly the arbitrage here, if I may. And so why wouldn't a company invert? Why would a company subject itself to this kind of this special kind of double taxation by being chartered in the United States, where we have this most onerous and unique tax requirement?
Well, I think there's a couple companies where it's really, you know, beneficial. If you have a company that's primary business is all in the U.S. and you're not a global company, then, you know, these other two benefits aren't particularly applicable. You know, correct? So that's one. But second, you know, there you can't simply, if you're a U.S. company and you simply move overseas, there is generally a cost associated with that structure, and that is a very general rule. Unless you meet certain requirements, you have to pay tax on the built-in gain of the assets that you currently have and have developed in the U.S. when you go through an inversion. It's only if you meet certain requirements that you can avoid that immediate tax on your built-in gain. As a result, there's a lot of companies out there that wouldn't do, you know, engage in an inversion because they're not going to make that upfront payment, cash payment, and tax payment in order to go through the inversion.
That quote-unquote exit cost would be significant.
Right. It's a big exit cost. Now, having said that, David, I would tell you that most people, if they actually sat down, the guy, you know, the person sitting down in his garage coming up with the next big thing, they would almost always, as a technical matter, almost always be advantaged by setting that first corporation up, not as a Delaware corp, not as a California corp or Nevada corp, but setting it up as a Cayman corp or another entity. It may not provide, frankly, immediate benefit because of there's some general rules that would prohibit, you know, taking full advantage of these in small corporations, but it would set you up so that down the road you could avoid the exit tax if whatever you've done has all of a sudden become a great raging success.
Very interesting. Okay, can you, again, sort of in advance of addressing the normative issues squarely, is it a separate issue that the one that we read about where we hear that Apple, Google, other large Silicon Valley corporations have billions of dollars in profits sitting offshore that can't be or is not being repatriated to the United States because of the firms trying to avoid the tax consequences of that repatriation? Can you break that down for us and explain to us what's happening there?
Sure. So you know, as we talked about, the general rule in the U.S. is that if you earn your foreign earnings will be subject to tax in the U.S. That's the general rule. There's an exception to that general rule that says your foreign earnings will only be taxed when repatriated to the U.S. If you keep them offshore and will quote unquote permanently reinvest them, so in non-U.S. activities, then you don't have to pay tax until you subsequently bring them back. So we've created a system, David, that has the perverse consequence that is actually encouraging U.S. companies to keep their earnings offshore. Otherwise, they face that double tax, that competitive disadvantage with regard to their German competitors when they're trying to address the Brazilian market, the Mexico market, the emerging markets in India. The only way that they can offer competitive pricing and guarantee competitive returns is by keeping that money offshore and reinvesting it offshore without having any U.S. involvement. Again, there's all kinds of workarounds and planning, but it's a general rule that's what's going on.
And so when we say keeping it offshore, we literally mean like in a bank account that is in a bank that is not within the borders of the United States, right? I mean, it just seems weird to me to when we're talking about money, to be talking about like where it is, you know? I mean, to say that the money gets repatriated to the United States, does that mean that it's repatriated when it literally lands in an American bank, you know, on the computer screen in an American bank? I mean, is that too, am I getting too conceptual with it? But I've always been confused on that point.
Yeah, no, it's really more of whether when it lands in the hands of a U.S. domiciled legal entity is where it happens, right? So, you know, it may or may not necessarily be in a U.S. bank, but if it's a foreign bank account of a U.S. legal entity, that it's the cash of that U.S. legal entity.
Yeah, so at one point, David, I think that people had contemplated a rule very similar to what you were saying, which is it can't even be in a U.S. bank. But I think people very quickly, in particular the banking groups, very quickly said, whoa, guys, you don't want to do that. You want the world of deposit its money in U.S. banks. You don't want the world. If you do that, all you're going to do is increase the banking going on in London and Hong Kong, right? So the banking industry at the time that these rules were put into place very consciously lobbied and were successful getting in Congress to provide that foreign companies that actually deposit their cash, maybe sitting in New York or wherever in the bank, that does not constitute repatriation. It's only when it moves ownership from that foreign company to a U.S. company.
That's right.
Okay, so now I think that there is, in American history, a longstanding populist suspicion about corporate activity that abides in our contemporary political discourse. But I think this suspicion about corporate operations often finds it difficult to articulate itself or difficult to express in a narrative that can contain its complaints or make explicit its complaints. And it seems to me that this issue of corporate taxation has provided a kind of narrative thread to critics of corporations that has that critics have latched onto, or that seems to be at least rhetorically persuasive and perhaps more substantively. So can you now address the ethos or the idea that is wrapped up in President Obama's declaration or innuendo that companies engaging in these inversions or maintaining money and offshore to keep it from being taxed are, quote, corporate deserters?
Yeah, so again, I'm going to go back to my very strong belief that this is just really political rhetoric. And actually, when you delve into the actual substance of the matter, it really has very little substance to it. And from that standpoint, I think that the reason you have this, as a general rule, I think the governments have overspent compared to the revenues that they have coming in. And without making a value judgment on whether or not the spending was good or not, they've spent more than they are taking in. And as a result, they are, many countries around the world, and you see this especially in Europe, where a lot of this rhetoric has been taking on a lot of steam, has been generated by governments that all of a sudden are panicking because they don't have an easy source of raising revenue. The biggest sources of revenue in almost every jurisdiction deal with personal income tax, personal sales tax in particular. But as you look at that anymore, David, it's really becoming unpopular to go out and try to raise income taxes, even on the 1% or the 0.1% anymore. France has got a 70% income tax. The U.S. is income tax on the 1%, which went through, is arguably it's getting up to a high level. the legislatures in all these various different countries are no longer, you know, they don't know that there's the political will to further that along. And it's a difficult thing for them to go in and say, I want to increase the sales tax, which or the VAT, which is the easiest and probably some in many countries is the biggest source of revenue for countries, because that's probably one of the most regressive taxes that there is. It always hits the, you know, disproportionately the poor and the middle class harder than the smaller group of the 1%. So, you know, as a result, you know, they're left with what can I look at? And an easy quote unquote target is the corporations. You know, it's easy to go and say, I want to tax them, right? It's the evil corporations, which to your point, historically are viewed as the pocketbook of the rich. So the general thought is that if I tax a corporation, somehow I'm not taxing the everyman. I'm taxing the fat cats that somehow are manipulating the system and unjustly being enriched at the expense of everybody else. I think therein lies one of the biggest, you know, problems with this entire argument as you go through it from a substantive and economic perspective. You know, the corporate fiction, corporations do not pay tax, not a dime. They never have, never will. That cost ultimately is borne by one of three groups. It's either borne, you know, it's either borne by employees through reduced wages, because you're taking that money out of the corporation's hands, giving it to the government, reduces wages. You're taking that it's being borne by the customers of the company, the consumers, because it's increasing the price. You know, the medical device tax is an excellent example of that. Or it's borne by the shareholders, which any more in particular, so that may hit, maybe have the populist view of hitting the fat cats, but on the economics view, it goes to the vast majority, hits the middle class in pension plans, in particular the unions. Who are very are much more you'll see get are on different sides of this argument than you'd expect, and as a result, you know, really the corporate tax is nothing more in my view than the politician's cheap shot at trying to circumvent and pull the wool over the electorate's eyes, saying, hey, we're not going to raise your income tax, sales tax, or wealth tax. We're going to tax the big bad corporations. Forget the fact that this is really a tax on you. Even the Congressional Budget Office, I mean, and as you look at the thing that really concerns me about this, David, is you look at this, even the Congressional Budget Office, who tends to be on a more, I would say, progressive side of economics analysis, says that, you know, they have a study out saying that 70% of the incident of the corporate income tax falls on the workers. It's not on the shareholders. It's not on the customers, but it falls on the workers and reduced wages. And the rest of it, for the vast majority, would first fall on the customers before it would fall on, as a general rule, then it would fall on the shareholders, because you're going to pass that on. You know, the investors and the owners of the capital are going to get their return. If they don't get it from one corporation here in the U.S., they're just going to move it and get it from a German company. So it's really hard to kind of force that tax onto the shareholders, you know, if they were able to do that. It generally almost always falls on the people that you would not want it to fall on, you know, in most economic arguments. So that's the kind of the, you know, I guess would be my first point when you look at that.
Well, and I think it's a profound one, Tim, and you and I discussed this on a previous at a previous conference, and that's from there I wanted to pursue this podcast conversation with you, and I want to follow this line of thinking a little bit further. So what I hear you saying is that the corporate tax itself obscures the politics of taxation, that we could imagine a world. There's no reason, really. There's no reason to tax corporations. We could have zero taxation of corporations, and let's imagine for a moment a world where we had 0% tax of corporations. And this is not an alien world or too mystical, because after all, partnerships, which can be very, very large in their operations, are not taxed at the entity level. Partnerships don't pay any tax. any income that is earned by a partnership goes is charged to the partners, and the partners pay an income tax on the income of the partnership. So you could have a world where corporations don't pay any tax, and you could raise the same amount of revenue let's just say all of the money that you're losing through corporate taxation is paid to the shareholders, because that's what I think progressives or populists believe, that all of the money that would be that is otherwise being taxed would go to the shareholders. Well, even if that were true, then you could just tax the shareholders, individually. Now, this may be fat cats, it may be the 1%, it may be the vast majority of Americans through their pension plans. Either way, the taxes are getting paid. You would increase the taxes on the back end to raise the same amount of revenue, but you would have greater clarity in the tax design, and a greater understanding of what the consequences were of raising or lowering a tax rate. That by having taxes being paid at this intermediate level of the corporate entity, it's an easy political target, but one that obscures the real consequences of the tax policy. I think if I've stated that right, then can you respond to the populist suspicion that lower corporate taxes results in higher profits for capital, higher profits for shareholders, but is not going to affect the prices paid by consumers or the wages paid to labor?
Yeah, so I mean, and David, that could be, this has been subject of economic debate for eons. I would tell you that, again, I think that there is a huge growing consensus, and again, that the labor and the wage earners bear at least 50% of the burden of the corporate income tax. And that's even the French will tell you that at this point.
Why is that? Can you explain why you say that labor actually is bearing a disproportionate percentage as compared to consumers or capital? Why wouldn't it be either that shareholders take it all, or that that sort of all of the stakeholders are bearing a more or less equal proportion of it? Why would it be that workers would take a heavier brunt?
Because the workers are the least mobile, is a general rule. If you look at the inputs, I think, into the production, workers are generally less mobile and are less able to go from company to company, as opposed to in most companies are all, if they're all under the same regime, there's no necessarily benefit, so they can't get an advantage. There's not a tax competition between the companies. So if you have Company A and Company B, both sitting in Silicon Valley, both employing the same people, they're going to have the same general tax structure. You're not going to get an advantage as a worker from moving across the street to work for Company B. As opposed to a consumer, if I have product A and product B, one's made and sold in my market, one's by the Silicon Valley company here, and one's by a company bringing something in from China or Japan or Korea. Let's just think about a cell phone. It's very easy for the consumer to make a flash decision in the store on what to buy. So it's very much hard. It's much more difficult for the company to kind of push that cost onto a consumer absent some motivating factor of technology advantage or product advantage. Similarly, with regard to the shareholder, the capital provider, if you will, the capital provider can invest. The world is his option. He can take his dollar and invest it in a company here in Silicon Valley, subject to a certain tax rate. Let's just assume 40%. Or he could put it into a company that's based out of Ireland in the same exact business line that's going to be subject to a tax rate of 10%. His return, he's just dramatically increased his after-tax return on his same dollar investment. So as you look at it, the people that are often the least able to move and take advantage of quote-unquote competition are the workers. Everybody else, the consumer and the capital provider, has much more leeway in that regard.
So that's great. Thank you for that explanation. But let me have one follow-up question that I still don't quite understand is, if you're saying that that if the way that the tax rate goes up, you know, say from zero, goes up, that the company's going to pay that by essentially taking away from the worker, and the worker can't do anything about it because the worker can't move easily. So why wasn't the company taking from the worker before the tax, if the company could have taken from the worker and given more to the shareholder or the consumer because labor can't move? Then why wasn't it already doing that?
Yeah, and if you look at it, David, I don't think it works quite that way. So if you increase corporate tax rates 5% year one, I don't think that there's a year one, everybody's taking a pay cut of 5%. That does not happen, and I don't think any economist would tell you that happens. I think that the way that you get to the reason that it impacts the workers is because as that goes through, so you increase the corporate tax rate by 5% for company A. It doesn't change for company B in another country. What's going to happen in year one is the corporate income, after-tax income, is less. When it comes around to core increases the next year, corporate A has got to figure out a way, if they want to maintain access to capital, they're going to have to give those capital providers a certain return. They're going to have to find ways of reducing their costs, which means that company A may give a 1% wage increase year two. Company B is giving its workers a 3% increase. Company A, so it may be wage increase. It may be that company A has the capital that it's going to invest in robotics, and it's going to make the worker in its company much more productive. But they can't do that if they've actually had to give that money to the government. So as a result, the effective rate of the compensation that those workers earn almost always reverts over the very short term to a situation where they're making less than their counterpart for the same position in a different environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how is it, as a matter of political economy, on this podcast we often have resort to what I refer to as the Citizens United gambit in corporate theory or corporate policy, which essentially emphasizes the role that corporations play in developing policy, in developing legislation or the regulations that would otherwise restrain corporate activity. And Citizens United tells us that corporations have a constitutional right to engage in that political activity. So how is it, as a matter of political economy, that we have such a messed up, from your perspective, such a messed up corporate tax code? Does this suggest that corporations don't have the influence in Washington that we otherwise presume that they do? Otherwise, they would have cleaned up this corporate tax problem.
Well, if you look at it, the question is, you know, do you have a corporate tax problem or don't you, right? And right now, we have the corporate tax regime that we wanted. And when I say we wanted, I'm using that globally. It was put in place. There's policy determinations that were made behind every single provision that was put in. The problem is, you know, they've been piecemealed, you know, and put one on top of the other for years. The last time that we had a major cleanup in the U.S. tax code was 1986, right? You know, since then, every year, you can imagine, David, the number of companies and the number of special interests that get in, just like the individuals, whether or not it's the unions looking for special breaks with regard to their medical plans, whether or not it's companies looking for investment credits for accelerated depreciation, the oil and gas companies. Everybody goes in, and every provision that's put in has a sound benefit that can easily be translated into jobs, into terms of benefits, into some locale. So it's not surprising or not unexpected that that happens. I think that happens across the board, whether or not it's corporate tax law, individual tax law, whether or not it's the medical regulatory environment, the food regulatory environment. You have the same things happening in every regulatory environment in our system. So So it doesn't surprise me that we are where we are. I think that there's a huge amount of push right now from corporations saying, you guys, you know, saying, hey, come on, now it's time that we clean things up again. The difficulty of trying to do this at this point is there to clean it up, to go through another event like you had in 1986, you almost need a transformational event, a catalyst to force that. And because there will be winners and there will be losers. You know, how are you, you know, who's going to end up paying what and how much are they going to end up paying and how do you do it? Some people love our system right now, which has a high corporate rate and then all kinds of special, you know, special provisions that they can use to force and encourage certain activities by offering benefits to allow companies to get down from that high corporate rate. Whereas, you know, many of us would say we'd be much better off by having a really low rate and having no, you know, incentives, let the market dictate the incentives instead of the government.
Mm-hmm. And then gain your revenue for the government. We might disagree about how much revenue the government should have or needs, but get your revenue from the government either through income taxation of shareholders or of workers or of sales taxation of consumers.
And maybe a combination of all. And then really, that's where the debate is. I mean, that's where the debate needs to lie, right, is how much money should the government have, which is a philosophical debate. And you know, I'm sure everybody has their own opinions on that. And then, two, once you decide how much of a role government should play and what it should be doing and what the funding it needs is, how you fund that, who should fund it. And, you know, what, you know, should every citizen have to pay something? Should it be progressive? Should it be, how regressive can it be? You know, all of those are valid discussion points, and I think are conversations that we would be much better off as a country to have that debate than simply, you know, sitting around talking about, the rules that kind of hide what we're really talking about, which are those really fundamental questions. How big do we want the government? What do we want them doing? How much should we give them to do that activity? And then who should pay for it? You know, right now we don't have that debate. You know, right now we're spending money that is going to be paid by people that aren't even born yet, which that's the best thing in the world to do, right? You can vote for somebody else that's not born yet to pay for your spending. It's kind of a perverse system where we can do that pretty easily.
Yes. Well, right. Unless we can presume that we're going to be that much more productive in the future, so it won't really be much of a burden to them at all, I guess would be the moral justification for taxing the future. One of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation, I'm so grateful to you gentlemen for us having it now, is as I learn and think about these issues, I just see how starkly confused or distinct the political discourse is. It's really like a couple of ships, several ships passing each other in the night. I mean, many political actors, President Obama, often will try to say that the corporate tax rate is so low. They'll point to the corporate tax rate as compared to the tax rate that natural people pay, and they'll say, look how low the corporate tax rate is, and they'll say corporations are fleeing the American domicile despite the fact that the corporate tax rate is so low. Yet you gentlemen are saying, no, they're fleeing because the corporate tax rate is so high, and compared to other countries, it is very high. And indeed, and this is an important element of the political conversation, the corporate tax rate is much higher in the United States than it is in other countries that arguably have more socialist type social safety nets or healthcare or education, etc. Right?
I think that's an important point, David. If you look at, and it's important to note, it's that the U.S. has the highest, not one of, but the highest statutory effective and marginal rate of any of the OECD countries, including Japan, which is shocking. I mean, it's a shocking situation to be in. So, I mean, it truly is a competitive issue.
It's not like these countries if you're concerned with providing sufficient government revenue for universal health care or other social safety net benefits, other countries are able to generate that revenue, and presumably they do it by taxing natural people rather than taxing corporations. And we're suggesting that at least they have greater clarity in their political conversations about the funding of government.
Yeah, I mean, in most of those countries, and again, you look in Europe, most of those countries have a VAT. So, I mean, most of those countries are paying somewhere between 10 and 20% VAT on normal purchases. That's just something in this country that has had no political legs. So I think politicians are grasping at anything they can to avoid having that conversation. Nobody, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, wants to go out and suggest we're going to have a national sales tax of 1%, 2%, 3%, let alone 15 or 20.
Right, and we're going to do that because we want to lower the corporate tax rate. It doesn't have much purchase in today's in the conventions of today's political conversation, but perhaps that can mature or evolve over time. I want to try to come back to the patriotism question as such and maybe come at it from a different angle, see what more we can do with it, if anything. So Judge Learned Hand, who is the author of The Spirit of Liberty, which I have on my desk right here, The Spirit of Liberty being a canonical essay in American patriotism. So if there are any authorities on what patriotism is, I guess Learned Hand would have to be counted among them. And yet he is also the author of one of the most famous statements in this area. And I'll quote it now. It's from a case called Gregory, or Helvering v. Gregory, from 1934, when Hand said, "Anyone may so arrange his affairs that his taxes shall be as low as possible. He is not bound to choose that pattern which will best pay the treasury. There is not even a patriotic duty to increase one's taxes." And then from another, so that's a famous statement in Surrey. Another case in 1947, Hand made a similar statement, a case called Newman, Commissioner v. Newman. You can do your Seinfeld impersonations out there. Commissioner v. Newman in 1947, when Hand said, "Over and over again, courts have said that there is nothing sinister in so arranging one's affairs as to keep taxes as low as possible. Everyone does so, rich or poor, and all do right, for nobody owes any public duty to pay more than the law demands. Taxes are enforced exactions, not voluntary contributions. To demand more in the name of morals is mere cant," or cant, C-A-N-T. So if we are to say that, I guess I want to ask this, is there any concept of corporate patriotism from the position, and I'm not asking you to speak for Flextronics here, but as individuals who are corporate officers in a quintessentially global corporation, if I may characterize Flextronics as such, is there such a thing anymore, or ever was there? Is there anything that we might call corporate patriotism? Let me just ask that question, and then I'll ask a follow-up.
Okay. So I think that an answer, and two, I want to make an observation, too. Let me delve into it. You know, first, I think that from a patriotic perspective, I think this is a rhetorical, political statement that's meant to, again, because corporations are associated with them, and them being the rich fat cats, it's a political statement meant to garner support for people in a soundbite that does not ever withstand much scrutiny. Is based on my experience. The reason I say that is because it's quickly disposed of. To say that a company moving offshore to reduce its taxes is being unpatriotic is the same as saying a company moving from California to Texas is un-Californian. Boeing moving from Washington to Chicago is un-Washingtonian and should be banned. Or to say that moving from individuals who are flooding my nice home state of Colorado are being are somehow immoral or unjust because they are leaving this great state of California to reside in the backwaters of Colorado, who's unjustly and uncharacteristically attracting people through unfair tax competition. It just doesn't withstand in my view much of a much analysis at all when you look at that.
Well, let me push back on that one, because I think that the Articles of Confederation were tossed off, and we formed a more perfect union through the Constitution in part to stop thinking of ourselves so very much as Californians or Texans or Coloradans, except in superficial senses that that there's a difference between an affection or a commitment to or sacrifice on behalf of a nation, as compared to subsidiary political divisions within the nation. So I think there's that questions of international movement are of a different kind normatively than within the national entity.
I hear that, David. That may just be a point we disagree on. From the same standpoint that an individual that leaves the U.S. to go to another country, most countries, there's a good analogy. Is that person unpatriotic for doing that? Is there something immoral by a U.S. by any individual choosing to be Mexican versus choosing to be U.S.? Choosing to be Canadian versus being choosing to be U.S. is the person that went to Canada to avoid taxes, is that wrong? If he wrong, but if he goes to avoid military service, that's good and noble. All of these are voluntary associations. The U.S. is one of the only countries in the world that seeks to force and impose punitive restrictions on you if you actually leave the country. Most other countries, when you leave, if I'm Irish and I want to go to the U.S., Irish is imposing a toll tax. The U.S. is one of the few countries that is of the opinion that, hey, if you lived here, we're going to tax you when you leave. So I understand the point, but I'd say I'm not necessarily convinced that it's a point that bears much difference. I still think it's a voluntary association, and whether or not you should be penalized, or whether or not the mere fact that I decide that I'm going to go live in another country makes me a good or bad person.
And so does that suggest, as we get a little deeper here, deeper still, I think we've been pretty does that suggest that the emergence of truly global corporations, global in capital, global in labor, global in consumer base, and mobile in terms of its domicile, are these global corporations rendering less relevant the very concept of the nation, will this become a less important organizing principle for human affairs in the lives of our children and grandchildren that you referred to shortly ago?
And I want to make sure I understand the question. So if you're asking whether or not the multinational, the economic ties make geographical, political boundaries less relevant, I think that the economic ties for sure bring the world closer together. They've made the world a tremendously safer place than it ever has been in the history of humankind, I would say. I mean, if you look at the period since World War II and the economic ties that we've had, Russia with Europe, China with the West and with the U.S., I think any conflict, if you will, as a general rule, becomes much more expensive and much more difficult thing to do. Notwithstanding your recent events in the Ukraine, but as you look at that, I think it's actually mitigated to bring the world closer together. So whether or not that's does that mean that you're going to move towards some kind of one world order? I think that's a question I'm not prepared to answer. I will say that as you look at the economic integration, in particular in Europe, the European Union, and that's a big experiment. You can definitely see with the hindsight of time, in a 20-year period, they've integrated far more closely than many people ever thought possible, since World War II. Are they going to continue on? Will they become a United States of Europe or a federation? Who knows? So I can't answer that question. But I will tell you, though, that from a corporate perspective, we're not sitting around trying to understand that. What we're trying to do is we've got a very clear goal, which is to operate our business as good corporate citizens to the benefit of our employees, our customers, and our shareholders, almost in that order. And I would say that most companies I know of, that's the way that they look at. Everybody focuses on the fact that you operate a company for the benefit of the shareholders. I don't think it's subject to much question at all right now that if you operate your company to the exclusion of the benefits of your employees or your customers, your shareholders get zero. So there's not a company out there right now that's not, looking at what do I need to do to attract, retain the best talent in the world? What do I need to do to attract and maintain my market position by creating the best product in the world? How do I do that in all the factors that go into it? And then if I do that, there'll be a little bit left over for the shareholders. And those shareholders may or may not be fat cats. They may or may not be the guy that's the public school teacher with the 401k or their para pension. It doesn't matter. But the ultimately, in almost every company that you look at, if you look at them from a CSER, the Corporate Social and Environmental Responsibility statements, the health and welfare of their employees is one of every company's top 5 or 10 issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's, thank you very, very much for that informed perspective. As you're talking, I find myself once again perplexed by the question of the nature of the corporate entity itself. I mean, earlier in the conversation you noted quite correctly that no corporation ever pays taxes, that there is no such thing as a corporation that loses money as a consequence of paying taxes, that these are paid by shareholders or workers or consumers. And yet, in this latter part of the conversation, in the statements you just made, it seems like you very much have a living idea of Flextronics as an entity, as a real organization that has different constituents and stakeholders that are being served by the corporate community. So, and I think that my own perspective is that is the view you described is sensible. It's not contradictory. That in some, when in thinking about some questions, we have to recognize the corporate fiction for what it is, and when we're talking about other issues, we have to appreciate the reality of the corporate existence.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I don't think that they're inconsistent at all. I think that with the informed approach right now, is they are integral. They're integrated parts that are interdependent, and that you will not be successful as a corporation for anybody unless you address all three concerns. You have to be focused on the market. You have to be focused on your employees, and you have to be focused on your shareholders. There is no boxing them up and treating them separately and operating to the exclusive benefit of one or the other. In the long, there may be a short-term, 1 year benefit for something, but anyone that's running a business for a sustained period of time, you have to focus on all three, which leads me to the interesting position that from an ethical and moral standpoint, I almost think that it's incumbent on anybody with the fiduciary ability at a company to manage its financial and fiscal affairs, that they have to take that all into account, and their goal, their specific moral objective, ethical requirement of executing their duty should be to pay exactly what's due, but not a penny more, and to make sure that they've got their company set up in the most advantageous structure to ensure they're paying only what they have to so that they can be the most competitive, that they can grow the fastest, that they can employ the most people at the best compensation, wherever that is, to provide benefits to more people around the world than they otherwise would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that perspective is not limited to the tax issue, right? And that's what I sort of wanted to ask before, and now I'll ask it in this context. Isn't it the case that in corporate operations, you should pay? Now you don't get the government doesn't tell you what to pay labor, except maybe a minimum. But doesn't the perspective you just described also translate then to saying you should pay labor exactly what you have to, but not a penny more? You should comply with environmental regulations exactly to the extent that the law requires, but not an ounce of pure air more, unless it's going to ultimately result in greater profitability for the firm.
Well, so and again, questioning into what do you mean by greater profitability. So I want to kind of unpack each one of those, because I think they can be used rhetorically more than when you get to the substance. When you look at the clean air, if there are clear understandings of what the kind, again, you start thinking of things in terms of ethics. To determine what the ethics are, you have to understand what the consequences of your actions are. I think that's vital into determining, am I operating? Are we operating in an ethical manner? Whether half the battle of saying, I don't think there's anybody out there. I've never, I've been in a lot of different board meetings. I've been in a lot of different business meetings. I've never, to my knowledge, been around somebody that thinks it's a great idea to, to have greater pollution, or that, doing something that's going to, cause harm is okay to do as long as it generates profit. I suspect there's bad actors out there, and of course you always hear about those guys first. And something that classic examples probably historically in the mining context. Some of those classic examples in the labor context, resulted in the very real need, in particular at certain points in our country's history for unions and some of the mining businesses in particular. But as you look at it now, David, I don't know that I that kind of rationale is still out there. I think that you have a more informed, as data has become more available and readily accessible, I think companies are making more informed decisions. And I think one of the best things that we can do is you have companies that have better data points, better understandings of what the consequences of their actions are, making those judgments. And ensuring companies have that judgment is a much better rationale than not. When it comes to terms of pay in particular, as you look at that, you're exactly right. You need to pay. Again, everything that every dime a company pays is borne by somebody. It's not borne by the company. So if it's labor, it's going to, as you go to labor, it's got to be, the market comparable labor. If it's not, whatever that labor pays, it's going into product cost, right? It's going into service cost. So that's being paid by those laborers or the customers. So it's that weighing, it's that balance. You have to walk within in the range of if I pay more here, does it increase my productivity, or am I going to get a benefit that's going to allow me to produce a bigger benefit for a customer? So those analyses are going on all the time.
Well, I think we could keep going and going and going, but I've taken an hour from you, gentlemen, and I think that I want to ask you to conclude, Tim and Jason, with some final thoughts on what reforms. I mean, we've talked about the possibility of a zero tax rate. That's obviously not politically plausible, but what reforms that might be politically feasible would you like to see pursued, or do you think that we'll see to begin to untangle this this predicament of corporate tax inversions?
Well, I can tell you that if you look back over what's happened over the past, say, 3-4 years, I think one of the good starting points would be some of the Bull-Simpson reforms. I mean, that was a broad bipartisan, committee that actually had some really good ideas. Again, for various purely political reasons, it wasn't even given serious consideration, right? So I think that there's, if you look at that kind of that proposal had a lot of good ideas in it. If you look, I think there's a great deal of support for, on the corporate side, reducing the corporate income tax simplifying the rest of the tax code, looking at things from an R&D perspective, looking at the provisions to eliminate the incentive to keep money offshore and to disadvantage U.S. companies by maybe moving towards a territorial system that would, you know, put the U.S. in the middle of the global norm with all our peers. And then really kind of focus on what do we want to do, have the discussion at a national level on what should the funding level be for our government. What is there a consensus that most people would agree that this is the appropriate level based on what we think they should be doing, and then have a real conversation on how should we fund that. Should we borrow? Is this something that we're creating value? To your point earlier, David, that there's going to be greater efficiencies and some kind of benefits for the people that, you know, we're going to be taxing in 20 years in the future. If there is, then maybe we continue to tax them by running at the deficit. If not, then maybe we need to look at other current ways to tax, fund the things that we want the government to do. And that may be something like, you know, VAT tax, income tax, or some kind of combination of the above. But I think the thing that really needs to happen, and I'd be happy without regard to what the result is, if we had an open and honest debate on what do we want the government to do, what do we want it to cost, and how do we pay for it.
Well, Tim, I think by having this conversation, I hope that we have elucidated some of the key issues and perhaps informed a deepening of that conversation. Well, gentlemen, I hope that as things do develop, I might have you both back on to talk further about this issue or other corporate ethics issues sometime down the road. Okay, thank you guys. Okay, that's it. That's our interview with Tim Seitz and Jason Spicer of Flextronics, the global technology manufacturing company. I'm truly grateful to these two gentlemen for sharing their enormous understanding of this very complicated area of law and social policy, and for their candor in having the conversation about the normative implications. Just a couple of clarifying points that I wanted to make in reflection on the conversation. That when we are talking about the corporate tax obscuring the country's tax policy, what I really mean is this. Tim made the argument that the corporate tax is borne disproportionate by workers, and that people generally are wrong to think that that tax is borne disproportionately by shareholders. I think Tim had some interesting arguments to make about why that might be the case, that workers bear the burden disproportionately of a corporate tax, or you could argue that consumers bear the burden. But it's difficult to tell, and it's a difficult theoretical problem and probably an impossible empirical question to decide who is really paying the corporate tax. And thus, it's difficult to evaluate the distributional consequences of the distributional burdens of our tax policy overall. If instead we had a zero tax policy, a zero corporate tax policy, then there would be greater transparency in the sense that we would know what is the tax burden of shareholders, what is the tax burden of workers, what is the tax burden of consumers, conceived as income tax to shareholders and workers, or capital gains taxes to shareholders, and sales tax to consumers. Of course, many individuals are both are workers and consumers and shareholders, but there would be greater transparency with respect to who is shouldering the nation's tax burden if taxes were paid directly by shareholders, workers, and consumers, rather than having it be paid by the intermediary that brings these three constituency groups together that we call the corporation. I don't know whether that's true or really holds up, whether there would be greater transparency, but that's the claim. A broader comment that I want to make in reflection is that I think after learning from Tim and Jason, talking with them, that it probably is a mistake to think about corporate tax inversions or corporate tax evasion or tax avoidance generally as a fundamental problem within corporate social responsibility. That is, even if you believe that we have a corporate problem in our society, that there is a there are socially deleterious dimensions to corporate operations in the United States, even if that is true, and I think that is true, that looking at corporate machinations with respect to their tax planning is probably not the most coherent or fruitful area to pursue in thinking about the problem of corporate social responsibility. It's obvious to me, or it seems to me after talking to Tim and Jason, that the corporate tax design is Byzantine and incoherent from a shareholder perspective and from a social perspective. And it seems that reforms to the current system, just even on a technical level, would make everybody better off without even having to address the more contentious issues involved in broader corporate social responsibility debates. I do nevertheless think there is a useful concept of corporate patriotism, and I am working on a project pursuing the question of the legitimacy of the concept of corporate patriotism. I'm not prepared to share those results right now, but I am prepared to say that I don't think corporate tax is the proper vantage from which to disparage a corporation's patriotic conscience, for reasons, again, that were elaborated, or put succinctly, rather, by Learned Hand. Okay, that's the end of our episode. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's David YOSIFON, at David Yosifon. I always tweet it out whenever I post a new episode in this podcast series. And you can subscribe to us on iTunes and get our new episodes automatically downloaded. Obviously, my comments at the beginning about the rain were ludicrous and uninformed and thoughtless. But also, there might have been something to them. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next time.